Hi there. Welcome to Book Stories People with me, Nancy Richards. You don't get anything more symbolically Cape Town than the harbour, the docks with the ships and seals and backdrop of Table Mountain. It's a bit of a classic, really. So for this Cape collection, I spoke to the author of Cape Town's Dockland, Brian Ingpen, Cape Town's shipping columnist who's been haunting the wharfs and quaysides since he was a kid on a bike decades ago. It's possible, he says, that the Phoenician, Chinese or Arab seafarers were here centuries past. But the first reliable records of Cape Town as a port are from the late 1400s, around the time of Bartholomew Diaz. And he would know, because Brian has researched and written 8 other shipping books, and he knows the comings and goings of the docks like the back of his hand. As an educationist, he's also co-founder of Law Hill Maritime Training Centre in Simonstown, where they're producing lots of young people for the shipping industry. Well, he says he didn't set out to write the definitive history of Cape Town's harbour, rather to capture its atmosphere. And I met up with him under the old clock tower at the waterfront, and I asked him to describe the atmosphere as he saw it now. Hi there. Welcome to Book Stories People with me, Nancy Richards.
Well, first of all, we're sitting at the old entrance of Cape Town's original harbour. The original harbour was called the Alfred Basin, with a little piece called the Outer Basin. And we're sitting at the entrance to that Alfred Basin. So if you had come to Cape Town from about 1870 to round about 1890, your ship would have entered the harbour through this narrow area that we call the Cut. On the opposite side is the port office, the old port office. Now it's turned into part of the amazingly successful waterfront. And just behind me is the old clock tower, which is a landmark for the area. It's an icon. The shape of the top has been used by architects in some of the more modern structures that have been put up as part of the waterfront. But the clock tower was the port captain's office, from which harbour movements were controlled, largely through loud hailers and flags and those sort of symbols. So it's a wonderful place to be. It's still a working harbour, not quite the same as it was when, as a small kid, I used to wander around here with my bicycle. But nevertheless, you do see tugs move, you see trawlers, you see other fishing boats, yachts, tourist vessels moving in and out. And then occasionally, over in the far side at East Pier, from which the mail ship used to depart for Southampton, up to the mid-1930s, that berth called East Pier is now occupied usually by the magnificent South African polar research and supply vessel, the SA Agulhas II, a really magnificent state-of-the-art vessel for polar conditions.
What we can also see, I've just seen, we've got 3 little seals sitting right here. One of them is a very young little seal. Have you seen lots of seals come and go since you've been coming?
Yes. Once the Alfred Basin had stopped being the main cargo and passenger terminal for Cape Town, and that went to Victoria Basin and then out to Duncan Dock and elsewhere, Alfred Basin was turned over to the fishing industry. So my first memories of Alfred Basin were clogged up with Irvin and Johnson trawlers, these old steam trawlers. There's a nice foghorn going in the background. These old steam trawlers that were coal burning. They would be berthed herringbone style with their bow towards the quay, discharging their fish. And of course, there were always something that fell overboard. And that's why the Alfred Basin was really full of seals. And even today we have them, and as I sit here, there are 4 of them now. They're 2 young ones and 2 adult seals. These are the Cape Fur seals, and they come up to rest on an area that the waterfront wisely has demarcated for them, and where tourists can look at them. We've just seen a family of 4 come and express great delight at these seals that come up here into the midst of this very busy working harbour.
We've also just seen a rather smart, I'm not sure what it was, but something just glided past. But also where we sit right behind me is the Robben Island Ferry, Quatuor. And that, of course, has changed the face of what goes on here too.
Yes, Robben Island has always been an important part of Cape Town's geography and, of course, its history. Originally, it was a place where the early settlers would go and collect penguin eggs or penguins themselves, I suppose, and crayfish, of course. Then it became a leper colony. It became all sorts of things. And then, of course, it became the notorious apartheid prison. And that is actually what has brought it to the public attention and put it firmly on the tourist map. We are sitting here just next to the Robben Island terminal. It's called the Nelson Mandela Gateway. And from here, the launches go out to Robben Island, taking tourists and, of course, the workers for the island.
Talking of gateway, I suppose the whole harbour in some way is a gateway. I'm not sure, as we look around you, your book is called Cape Town's Dockland, what the extent of the dockland is. But dating back to 14, whenever it was that Bartholomew Dias came in, and even before that, it's been a gateway to the whole continent, really, hasn't it?
Yes, the Dutch established their halfway station on the route from Europe to the east at the Cape. It was chosen because of a fable report by members of the crew of Haarlem that was wrecked here. They had even planted some vegetables and some grain that they'd salvaged from the ship, and it grew quite well, and they reported very favorably, and so the Cape was chosen as this halfway place to the east. It started as a very small settlement, and I understand that the Dutch never intended it to be a colony, rather just a stopping place. But, of course, it grew. There weren't only Dutch ships stopping here. There were British, French, you name it. They all called here, mainly for fresh water, and that's why Cape Town was popular, because of a stream running down from Table Mountain, perennial stream, from which fresh water could be obtained. So the Cape was chosen as the place for this halfway station, and it grew to be a very important port in world trade and continues to be that. And so as shipping changed and technology changed, we had, of course, things like the Diamond Rush and the Gold Rush and the Anglo-Boer War and so on that caused a large number of people and equipment to be landed here, and the harbour that had been built was far too small, and so it was extended to what became the Victoria Basin. That became rather cramped as the size of ships increased, and they built the Duncan Dock in two stages, and then during the war it was completed with a huge area of land reclaimed from the sea. And that area of land we now know as the foreshore, and today has some of Cape Town's tallest buildings on it. But the old pictures are really evocative of that time in Cape Town, with fishermen landing their catches on an area that now is the footprint of huge buildings. But that harbour, the Duncan Dock, was completed. We had the biggest dry dock in the southern hemisphere and in Africa built as well. Still remains with those titles. And then, of course, with containerization, the whole thing changed, and we had to build a container terminal on the outer side of the Duncan Dock. And that is now the fulcrum of most of the cargo work for Cape Town. And with that came a huge change in the rest of the harbour. The older harbour was almost redundant, because one of those big container ships took the place of five conventional ships, carried the equivalent cargo that five conventional ships would carry. And so there wasn't the need for the rather sprawling harbour area that we had. And so it was focused largely at the container terminal. And that meant that there were tracts of land and buildings and things that were lying derelict, shall we say. And then we had some very enterprising people who looked at this and thought, well, maybe we can do something with this. And over time, they turned it into this most successful waterfront, with thousands and thousands of visitors. Even during COVID times, the waterfront, while it has been empty and so on and fewer people, but it's magnificent. One can have breakfast or dine with the backdrop of Table Mountain, and of course see the passing traffic of these smaller vessels and the tugs that move.
You might have to compete with the seagulls for your breakfast. But it's interesting that you talk about the Diamond Rush and the fishing industry, because as I walked in, I saw a ship offloading their catch of probably tuna, so the fishing continues. And in your shipping column just yesterday, you were talking about diamond retrieval vessel. So in some ways, while things have changed, things have very much stayed the same. Is it very different from when you used to come down as a kid? I think you used to come down and beg your way, talk your way onto the odd tug. Is it very, very changed?
It has changed. Part of what used to be a thriving cargo area, particularly for the coastal cargoes, is now the fulcrum of Cape Town's fishing industry. We have large fishing companies now occupying what used to be cargo sheds, and of course their trawlers are berthed along those berths that used to be occupied by coasters coming in from Durban or Walvis Bay or wherever. And of course we've also got the tourist trade. We have just across the way over in the distance there's what we call a super yacht. In other words, somebody's very nice small floating palace, and that's one of the areas that I think the waterfront folks are going to concentrate on to try to develop further. We've also got two very important vessels in port at the moment, having just completed two very, very good operations. The one is the salvage tug, the SA Mundler, which is 45 years old. South African built, South African operated, South African crewed, and just last week she towed into Durban a huge container ship, 360 meters long, with thousands of containers on board, and she towed that ship successfully into Durban from where the vessel had broken down off Cape Agulhas. And the other one is a new vessel, also of the same company, a company called AMSOL. And they're going to be operating this vessel on a variety of uses. She can do a number of jobs other than just tow ships. But she herself, on her maiden voyage to Cape Town, in fact, picked up a tow well south of Cape Agulhas and brought it in yesterday. So we also have a salvage function here. But the harbour has changed remarkably. Wharves where I used to pedal with my bicycle now are either the fishing wharves, or they are filled with luxury vessels or tourist craft or whatever. And those wonderful days spent riding on tugs in the harbour have come to an end. A young lad of, as I would have been, 10, 12, coming to the tug berth now would be greeted by a huge security fence and a guard who would chase him away. Those days, there was no such thing. The tug berth was open, and then ask the tug master if he was going out, and if he was, yes, he'd welcome us aboard. We never turned away. It was amazing. And out we'd go, because many of those tug masters themselves as young kids had done exactly what we were doing, and they understood us. And we learned such a lot. You know, it was the geography of the world. Where's the ship from? We see she's registered in Panama. Where's that? Where's she come from? She's come from Rio de Janeiro. Where's this one going to? Oh, no, she's going to Australia. So our geography was improved. We watched cargoes being unloaded and loaded, the fruit going out of Cape Town from the huge fruit terminal that we had, all going in containers now, so nobody can see what's in those containers. Before, we would see these pallets, hundreds of pallets, thousands of pallets being loaded into fruit ships. Sometimes there were four fruit ships in with their holds ready cooled to the appropriate temperature for the fruit. And then off the ship would go to Europe or to Britain with that cargo, and the fruit would arrive. And of course, that the invention of refrigeration in ships towards the end of the 19th century opened up a huge market for the South African fruit farmers. And so our citrus, deciduous fruit, and our grapes find great markets overseas. They always have. Now everything goes in containers, refrigerated containers. Some of those containers themselves have climate control, atmospheric control attached to them, so that the ripening of the fruit can be controlled and timed to when the ship arrives in its destination. So a lot of scientific endeavor at the moment in shipping. We see bigger ships. The container ships now are really big. Many of them are well over 300 meters long. That's three football fields. Some of them carry thousands and thousands and thousands of containers. So we see these ships. We see them anchoring in the bay because the container terminal is busy, particularly at the fruit season. And, of course, we get the southeaster that delays cargo operations in the container terminal. So there's even more of a delay sometimes. But it's a very busy, it's a fascinating place, and it's just a pity that it's closed off now behind barbed wire, that we can't get our young people in there as we used to do. We understand the reasons, but it's just unfortunate that so many young people who'd love to are denied that opportunity to wander around the harbour. And of course, we used to get onto ships, never turned away. They would just caution us as to where we shouldn't go on the ship. Sometimes we even got a guided tour of the ship by somebody who had nothing else to do. But it was a wonderful time, the 50s, 60s, and even to some extent the 70s. What changed it all, of course, was 9/11, when security was enforced in all major ports throughout the world because of the threat of terrorism and so on. So we understand that to a point, but what we would plead is that the harbour authorities would make public viewing areas in the harbour. At an airport, there's usually a place where they can have a hamburger while they watch the planes come and go. And to some extent, that's true of the waterfront, but it's not the actual working harbour. They don't see cargo being loaded and discharged. They don't see the tugs in operation. Understand the reasons, but we would say that there needs to be some sort of adaptation of that security curtain that has been thrown around the harbour. Breakwater, for example, is off limits. That was a great place. Cycle out to the end, watch people fish. The folks from the hotels at the waterfront used to be able to walk or jog out there before, after dinner. Sadly, that's also fallen foul, and a big security fence now keeps people away.
It keeps people away, but there's a lot to keep people here. Of all the things that you're describing there, I'm seeing industries coming and going and growing and burgeoning. The container shipping industry has been huge. Fishing industry has been huge. And possibly biggest of all has been the cruise ship industry, where we see these, as you call them, floating palaces, literally like blocks of flats coming in. And yet, I think due to COVID, that has all sort of fallen foul. But the cruise ship industry started back in the 30s. In your book, I think some of the earliest cruise ships were the 30s.
Yeah, the cruise industry has grown worldwide remarkably in the last, shall we say, 50 years. Prior to World War II, occasional cruise ships used to come here. They were usually vessels that otherwise might have been going, taking passengers across the North Atlantic, but in the North Atlantic winter, it could be uncomfortable. And so some of the companies diverted some of their ships to cruising. And so we would see them here. After World War II, we also saw the occasional vessel here. The Caronia was a popular vessel that used to come here about every year. She was lime green in color, so very standoutish, and she had a huge red and black funnel. So she was very conspicuous in the harbor. She was, of course, replaced by the famous QE2, probably the best-known ship of all time, apart from Titanic for other reasons. And QE2 was magnificent. Her first call here in the 1970, somewhere there, was marred by the Southeaster, and she anchored off Sea Point, which is a suburb around the corner from the harbor, for a day or two, and then came in, and it took some pretty smart piloting to get her in and to put her alongside without damage. She nearly ran away from the tugs that were shepherding her into the berth, but fortunately, again, the experience of the pilot and the tug masters saved the day. And then gradually it started to grow, but of course South Africa wasn't on the tourist map during the apartheid years, and in subsequent years the cruise industry has blossomed. And fortunately, the Port Authority built a cruise terminal for our harbour. It's probably a little bit too small for some of the ships, but nevertheless, it serves the purpose. And so during the summer season, there was a flow of cruise ships, virtually one in every day, from round about October through to April. And fascinating to see these ships come in. They much, much bigger than those wonderful Union Castle ships that we used to have here, carrying more passengers. Some of them are smaller, but they look like floating blocks of flats rather than the smooth lines of the old, what you call them, the mail ships, Union Castle mail ships. Now, that was a tradition of Cape Town that I think is unsurpassed anywhere in the world, because every Friday at 4 o'clock, not 5 to 4 or 5 past 4, but at 4 o'clock, the mail ship, which was a passenger ship carrying about 700 passengers and about 15,000 tons of cargo, sailed for Southampton, usually full of passengers, particularly in the Northern Hemisphere summer. And people left to go on the holiday of the lifetime, particularly before air travel became popular. Some people left South Africa to start lives elsewhere. And so that Friday afternoon at 4 o'clock was a poignant time. People leaving for short duration times overseas, others leaving for good. And the people who were waiting on the quay were streamers. When that streamer broke as the ship drew away from the quay, that was the severing of a relationship perhaps. And perhaps they'd never see, the folks on the ship would not see their relatives again. So it was a very poignant time every Friday that happened. And then about 1,000 people would turn out to watch that ship sail. Visitors were allowed on board just up to about 3:30. At 3:30, everybody who wasn't sailing in the ship had to go ashore. And then the gangway would be raised and away the ship sailed. And the other interesting thing about those mail ships is they were called that because they had a contract. And the contract was with the British and South African governments to deliver mail to and from South Africa. And that required that every Thursday morning, the ship from the UK would arrive off Cape Town at 5 o'clock in the morning. Pilot would board, and she would be alongside at 6 o'clock in the morning. And the first things ashore were the mail. And hundreds of bags of mail were put ashore. The efficiency of the post office at that time was such that mail that came ashore that morning was delivered that afternoon. I used to get a comic. My mother used to get Women's Weekly. My brother used to get a magazine called Hobbies Weekly. Every week, the mail ship would bring that. And by 3:30 in the afternoon, when I got home from school, there were the three magazines in our letterbox. A remarkable thing before computers. And so it was just a wonderful system that was in place. If the mail ship was late, it was front page news. If she was delayed leaving because of the southeast gale or whatever, it was also front page news. So I don't think there's any other port in the world that had a vessel arriving from a foreign port at a particular time on a particular day of the week and then sailing at a particular day and a particular time on a Friday that got moved to Wednesday later on when the service speeded up. But those were wonderful days. The voyage to the UK was just marvelous. The food on board, even for the fellows down near the propellers, it was just amazing. And the entertainment was virtually non-stop. Every evening there was something. Every afternoon there was something. Yet it lacked the glitz of the modern cruise ship. It was, in fact, shall we say, more genteel. Just seeing a small tug coming into its berth. She's turning to starboard, and she'll go alongside her berth up near the old Robben Island terminal where the prisoners and warders used to be ferried backwards and forwards. Oh, see, she's not going to the berth. She's, in fact, coming through the cut, as the ships would have done a century or more ago.
And she's the little Kestrel, and what a dear little thing she is. Gosh, so much nostalgia, so much history, Brian, so much of it personal. In your book, you describe all your collections of postcards of ships, but it wasn't just your memories that you trawled to put together this book. It was the collections of other people, photographic collections, thousands and thousands of negatives that you inherited from George Young. It's a huge thing, and your book is a real tribute to the past, but it's also it's a window on the future. It's a window on the present. And I think you personally, as an educationalist, I think you're very keen to encourage specifically young people to take an interest in the shipping industry. The Law Hill Marine Centre, which is in Simonstown, you're busy training up there, or there are many young people being trained up there, to do what exactly?
Yeah, the Law Hill Maritime Centre, it's part of Simonstown School. Back in 1995, the school was looking for something special to offer its students. And at the time, Safreen, which was then South Africa's major shipping company, was looking to invest in education. So the two synergies met, and the Law Hill Maritime Centre began. Initially, it was a bit ad hoc, but from 1997, Act was formalized as the subjects that were offered. There were two maritime-related subjects, one to do with navigation and seamanship, and the other to do with the shipping industry ashore. And here comes another vessel.
There's something huge coming in now. What is this?
This is a Taiwanese long liner. They go out to sea. You can hear the hum of her engine as she comes through and her generator. Here she comes. And these vessels, they're probably about 50 meters long. They go out to sea for weeks at a time. They lay out a long line, and attached to that long line are baited hooks. And the fish then, and hopefully for them it's tuna, go and take the bait, and then they move up and down that long line and pull in the fish that have been caught. Sadly, other things also get caught there, including albatross or turtles or dolphins. But it is a major industry for Cape Town, and these vessels contribute a huge amount to the revenue of Cape Town Harbour through their port dues, their pilotage charges and so on. They take stores here, they take fuel, they transship their cargo. Some of the cargo is, when it comes out of the vessel, is frozen, and it goes directly into refrigerated containers at where the temperature is set at minus 25, and then it's taken on ships out to the Orient. So it's a huge industry, and we have a special berth here with a special facility where the frozen fish are kept prior to shipping. So it's a huge industry contributing a massive amount of money to Cape Town with the services that they use and also the harbour fees that they are charged.
Yeah, and I have to say it wasn't just fishing lines that they had. They had washing lines hanging all over that little ship and all the sailors who obviously had been out at sea for a long time were all there with their cell phones taking shots of the beautiful harbour that we have here.
Yeah. That vessel, by the way, would have been going to what's called the synchrolift, which is a lifting device where the vessels are lifted clear out of the water and are put onto the hard so that they can be painted or repairs to their propeller shafts or whatever. So that's another area of Cape Town Harbour that is very busy, the ship repair industry. We've got the dry dock that was the old dry dock that is part of the waterfront but still a working dry dock. That was built in 1870. We have the Sturrock Dry Dock, which, as I mentioned, was this large dry dock, about 360-something meters long, capable of taking some very large ships, but sadly a bit too narrow for the modern big ships. And then we've got the synchro lift, which lifts them out of the water. That's only for small ships, the synchro lift, so vessels of 50 meters, 70 meters, etc., can be lifted clear out of the water for their underwater work.
You are a mine of information. You are a shipload of information. It's just extraordinary. And I know that you're doing wonderful things at the Lawhill Maritime Centre.
I was talking about that.
Yes,
when
I know.
Trawler came past.
Let me give you the opportunity just to finish that.
Yes, the Lawhill Centre was founded way back initially, an ad hoc basis in 1995. 1997, it became a full part of the education system of South Africa. And there are two maritime subjects that are offered, and I've been privileged to be part of that for 23 years, retired end of 2019. And young people from all over the country attend because there's a boarding facility for 67 young people. And they do normal school subjects, two languages, mathematics, physics, and then they do three maritime subjects. There's another subject that's recently been introduced called marine science, and that's a combination of oceanography and marine biology. So a student leaving the Lawhill Maritime Center at the end of his schooling, after 12 years of schooling, the last three having been at Lawhill, he would have had a very good grounding in three aspects of the maritime industry, the navigation and seamanship and cargo handling. He would also have had the economic side of shipping and the ship chartering and ship owning and ship financing and so on. And he'd also have a good grounding in the sea itself, this very fragile environment that is under such threat these days from plastics and whatever. So he would understand the need to protect that environment at all costs. And the seals that are looking at us down here, including a family of two young seals and mama, they're testimony to that.
Yes, and we're very pleased to see that they are free of plastic around their neck.
Yes.
And you talk about the young people at Law Hill and being he, but I do believe that there are she's as well. So I think there are young men and women there. Brian, there's so much more to be said, and there's so much information in your book. It's an absolute treat to have it. And I think if anybody would like to get hold of a copy, best to send you an email. It's brian@capeports.co.za, brian@capeports.co.za. One last thing that you can see. What else can you see?
I can see families enjoying their time down here at the waterfront. And also, I can just see some of the really old parts of the waterfront that date me a bit, but I remember them when cargo ships used to come in and discharge or load their cargoes. Great fun being down here when a ship came into the Victoria Basin, narrow confines, ship up close, tug pulling, really dramatic stuff. And of course to watch all that cargo being unloaded and loaded, just great. Absolutely wonderful experience to be down here as a young person in the 50s and 60s and even the 70s.
And even as an older person, and I can see the sun coming out, and I know that there are lots of nice coffee shops, so I'm going to treat you to a cup of coffee, if I may. Brian Ingpen, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Nancy, and all the very best to you. Thank you.